This is the NPR News Update. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. Coming up, Minneapolis and the Met Council have reached a tentative agreement on the Southwest Light Rail line, but not everyone is happy about it. Home health workers are going ahead with a union vote. Would a little bit of inflation be good for the economy? Well, one prominent banker says yes. And the latest in a series on health disparities in Minnesota. I'm John Wanamaker. It's Thursday, July 9th. Even though Minneapolis and the Metropolitan Council have struck a tentative deal on Southwest Light Rail, the proposed line remains deeply divisive. Hundreds of city residents attended a public meeting held last night, but the compromise appeared to have won few new supporters for the project. Curtis Gilbert reports.
Even Mayor Betsy Hodges says the deal isn't perfect.
This is not what we had started off expecting from this corridor. There are great costs to the city as a result of moving forward in this way, and that has to be acknowledged.
In spite of those costs, the mayor says she wholeheartedly endorses the agreement, which she, two council members, and city staff negotiated behind closed doors with the Metropolitan Council. At the heart of the agreement is a scaled-back version of the so-called shallow tunnel proposal. Rather than building two tunnels for the trains as they pass through the Kenilworth corridor between Cedar Lake and Lake of the Isles, there would be only one tunnel, the one south of the channel between the two lakes. Instead of a tunnel north of the channel, the trains would run at ground level. Bob Sherman lives near that part of the planned route. At last night's meeting, he said eliminating the North Tunnel only makes the project worse.
The overall effect of this is going to be extremely disruptive, both in the construction and in the final product, to the peace and gentility of the neighborhood in which I live.
City officials say getting rid of the North Tunnel will actually make the construction process less intrusive, but they acknowledge eliminating it would mean more noise for some neighbors once trains start running. The deal also gives residents near the Kenilworth corridor a place to board the light rail trains at 21st Street. But Sherman isn't thrilled about that either.
From my point of view, and probably many around me who will not be using it, would find it only a disruptive influx of traffic we don't want.
The line would connect Minneapolis to St. Louis Park, Hopkins, Minnetonka, and Eden Prairie. Its supporters also turned out for the meeting. Gerald Savage predicted that without support from Minneapolis, the project would be mothballed and future transit improvements would go elsewhere, damaging the city's tax base.
So the prudent thing to do is to focus on the majority of the property owners and not just the 0.01% in Kenilworth. Minneapolis needs to move forward with the Southwest Light Rail Project.
But some supporters of the line are skeptical of the deal. Several groups representing minority residents wanted to see the city win more concessions that would improve transit in North Minneapolis. Pastor Paul Slack, president of the faith-based group Isaiah, was part of the so-called Equity Coalition.
We know that Met Council is proposing some equity planning coming up, but frankly, it looks rather weak.
The council's racial equity plan, announced separately from the deal with the city, does include some of the items Slack's coalition wanted, including 75 new bus shelters by the end of next year. The Met Council will release additional details later today. By the end of the three-hour meeting, it was clear that most people who supported the line before the deal still supported it, and most opponents remain unmoved. Former City Councilmember Tony Scallon noted Southwest Light Rail isn't the first divisive transit project Minneapolis has dealt with.
The Hiawatha one was controversial. The University one was controversial. And folks, this is going to be controversial, and I wish you well. But stick to it. Build the light rail.
The City Council's Transportation and Public Works Committee took no action last night. It and the full City Council won't have to vote on the proposal until next month. And there will be several more opportunities for the public to weigh in before that. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
In the lead-up to the August primary, four Republican candidates seeking to unseat Governor Mark Dayton this fall are using the issue of education to rally supporters. Minnesota has one of the widest achievement gaps between white students and students of color, for which the GOP candidates are offering a range of remedies. Catherine Richard has more.
Earlier this year, data released by the Department of Education showed Minnesota had made some gains in closing the achievement gap. Still, it remains stubbornly high, with test scores for students of color lagging their white peers by as much as 30 percentage points. The issue has provided political opportunity for Republicans looking to oust Dayton in the general election. That includes the party's endorsed candidate, Jeff Johnson.
The fact that we have either the worst or one of the worst achievement gaps in the country year after year after year for 20-some years now is just, I think it's shocking and it's shameful. And we love to talk about it, but then we never change the system. And that's what we have to do is change the system.
Johnson says the state can't close the achievement gap with money. It's going to take big policy changes instead. And that's why he would consider adopting a California plan in Minnesota. There, poorly performing public schools can be overhauled or shut down if a majority of parents agree. The policy is known as the parent trigger. It was put into law in 2010 and pushed in part by charter school advocates. Proponents of the trigger argue it gives parents more say in their child's education. But the trigger remains controversial in California. At some schools, it's caused strife between teachers and parents, and at others, it's addressed frustrations with school governance, but not the quality of the teaching. So far, education experts say there's no evidence that the parent trigger has narrowed California's achievement gap. John Rogers is a professor at UCLA.
It presumes that the achievement gap is caused by a lack of quality governance rather than what research has said, which is that achievement gaps emerge as we have segregated schools that provide unequal quality of education across different communities.
Maple Grove Representative Kurt Zellers is also running in the GOP primary. He says he would support the parent trigger as well. But he would also support school vouchers. These are government scholarships that help students in low-performing public schools go to private schools.
If you want to go to a charter school, if you want to go to a religious-based or a STEM school-based, if you're a kid in Brooklyn Park, you should be able to go to that school in Anoka.
The state allows kids to go to any public or charter school they want, so long as they have transportation. All the GOP candidates say they would support vouchers, including Orono businessman Scott Honor. He says he would also support a similar law to one Dayton vetoed in 2012 that would eliminate seniority as a factor when laying off teaching staff.
We have to give local school districts, school boards, and principals and superintendents the tools to make sure that they're pursuing excellence amongst teachers.
GOP candidate Marty Seifert proposes keeping kids in the classroom longer every day.
Now, I don't know if it's the union bargaining it away, I don't know if it's the school bus company dictating it or the coaches and the sports programs, but whoever it is, we need to tell them, you know what, schools primarily are there for academic instruction, and we need to stop bargaining our school day away.
That's an idea Dayton has said he would support too. But even if any of these candidates beat Dayton in the fall, their proposals would require approval from the state legislature. While Republicans have a shot at flipping the Minnesota House, the DFL-controlled Senate isn't up for re-election for two more years. Catherine Richert, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Home health care workers in Minnesota are moving ahead with a union election, even though the U.S. Supreme Court ruled last week that similar workers don't have to pay any union dues. Union organizers presented a petition to state officials yesterday in St. Paul, and they said it will trigger the largest vote of its kind in state history. Tim Pugmire reports.
Legislation passed in 2013 allowed for a unionization vote among those who provide care to elderly and disabled people in their homes. There are more than 26,000 workers who are eligible to vote, and the 9,000 cards delivered to the State Bureau of Mediation Services exceeded the 30% required to trigger an election. At a rally outside the Bureau office, Tyler Frank of Minneapolis said the high turnover rate among personal care assistants means he has to spend more time caring for his partner, Nicole.
When home care workers finally receive the attention and the respect that we deserve for the difficult work that we do, when our jobs are finally seen as the careers that they are, Nicole can finally get the reliable help that she needs to thrive. And with that steady help, I'll no longer have to choose between my goals and hers.
Frank and other union advocates are seeking representation from the Service Employees International Union, which began its organization effort shortly after the 2012 election. Rosemary Van Vickle of Crosby said she just wants to be able to count on some basic things, such as fair pay, sick days, and paid time off.
Now, I and other home care workers in Crosby have decided that we are going to fight to make home care jobs good jobs and make sure everyone across the whole state is able to get care in their home.
Organizers delivered their petition a week after the U.S. Supreme Court said similar workers in Illinois cannot be forced to pay full or partial union dues if they don't want to join, because they are not full-fledged public employees. Summer Spica of St. Paul said home care workers still have the right to organize, but she said the plan now is to no longer seek partial dues from those who object. Spica said that she doesn't know whether those workers will still benefit from union representation.
I don't know all the details of that. We haven't formed our union is not officially formed yet, so I'm sure those things will get worked out as we move along in the process.
Spica contends there is broad support for forming a union, but others disagree. Republican Representative Tara Mack of Apple Valley, who was a vocal opponent of the 2013 legislation that authorized the union election, said she was disappointed to see the effort moving forward, especially after the Supreme Court ruling. Mack said she continues to hear from personal care assistants who care for family members and don't want anything to do with a union.
They just want to take care of a loved one and get some government assistance in order to do that and make it possible. And so there's a huge concern among the advocates trying to stop the unionization that this would have a disincentive and kind of a dampening effect on people wanting to take care of their family and loved ones.
Mack said she thinks some Minnesota opponents might try their own legal challenge to stop the union vote, but she did not provide any specifics. Josh Tilson, commissioner of the Bureau of Mediation Services, said the petition delivery begins an administrative process for conducting a unionization election. He said the specific timetable for the voting is not yet set, but will be posted in an election order later this week. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The president of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank, Narayana Kocherlakota, told business leaders yesterday that a rise in inflation would be a good sign for the economy. Martin Moylan reports.
The Minneapolis Fed president was speaking to corporate CEOs and other members of the Minnesota Business Partnership. He noted that inflation, on average, has been under the Fed's 2% target since the start of the Great Recession and could stay under that goal for several years. Kocherlakota says this is a sign the economy is not performing all that well.
When inflation is low compared to our target, that's telling you that demand for goods and services is too low to fully use available resources in the economy.
The local Fed leader also said weak inflation hurts homeowners and other borrowers by effectively making it more expensive to pay off debt. Kocherlakota also said low inflation indicates weak demand for labor, which makes it harder for the unemployed to find work. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Two proposals that address the changing taxi and rideshare industries have been approved by a Minneapolis City Council panel. Peter Cox has details.
One ordinance amendment legalizes ride-sharing services like UberX and Lyft, which have been operating without official sanction. The other eases regulations on the city's taxis. While cab companies and drivers were happy with the changes, they argue that the ordinances essentially give two separate sets of rules to companies working in the same industry. Steve Pint is the president and CEO of Taxi Services, Inc., the largest taxi company in the Twin Cities.
All the items that were regulated heavily on still exist. There's been some concessions to those regulations, but nominal.
The ordinance amendments now head to the full city council for a possible vote next week. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
Three women were seriously injured in an early morning shooting in North Minneapolis. The latest incident follows shootings over the July 4th weekend that left two people dead and at least three injured. Police have made arrests in two of those cases. The latest shooting occurred around 1:30 this morning. The victims were taken to North Memorial Medical Center, where police say they are in serious condition. Police Chief Janae Harto walked along West Broadway Avenue in North Minneapolis yesterday. She talked to residents about what the department is doing to reduce violence in their neighborhoods, but Harto said there's only so much police can do, and she asked for more cooperation from the community.
You know what? People in this neighborhood know exactly who commits the crimes. They know when they're going to happen, and we need to have that conversation before it happens. People need to feel empowered. I don't want to over-police. I want to over-protect.
Harto says shooting and shots fired calls for service in North Minneapolis are up by more than a third so far this year compared to last year. A 7-year-old Malacca girl has died after being struck and killed while riding her bicycle yesterday. The State Patrol says Alyssa Grimm was riding in the westbound lane of Mille Lacs County Road 8 at about 10:20 last night when a westbound car struck her. She was taken to North Memorial Hospital in Robbinsdale, where she died. Neither the 29-year-old driver nor his passenger were hurt. Alcohol is not believed to be involved in that incident. This is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. A report out this week from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association says the group reached about 16,000 deer in an emergency feeding effort last winter. Dan Crocker has more.
The association coordinated the six-week effort in March and April. The group's Jenny Foley says mobilizing nearly 1,000 volunteers to distribute more than 500 tons of food was a logistical challenge.
Organizing the trucks and getting people out and getting people to hand out the bags.
The group distributed feed at over 1,100 sites in northeastern Minnesota, where the winter was especially severe. The $200,000 effort was covered by an emergency deer feeding account that hunters fund with a 50-cent license surcharge. The Department of Natural Resources opposes feeding, saying it's ineffective and can spread disease. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
The state of Minnesota collects a vast amount of data about the health of its citizens. These include mortality rates from various causes, rates of communicable disease, and of chronic illnesses like diabetes. Those data informed a groundbreaking report by the Minnesota Department of Health earlier this year on the worsening disparities in health and health care access between Minnesota's majority white population and people of color. NPR News, in collaboration with American Public Media's Healthy States Project, offer a series of reports on the use of data to address Minnesota's health disparities. Today, the disparities around asthma. Lorna Benson reports.
In some zip codes in Minneapolis, the risk of experiencing a life-threatening asthma attack is nearly six times higher than it is in most other areas of the state.
You can hear loud and clear.
Danica Jackson and her son Keontae Gaskin, who are both African American, live at ground zero for the worst asthma problem in the Twin Cities, just a few steps away from Interstate 94 in North Minneapolis. The 55411 zip code has the highest asthma hospitalization rate in the 7-county metro area.
If you come off my front porch and walk to about 10, 15 feet, you're at the corner and across the wall is the freeway. That's the only really thing that's blocking my house from the freeway is the wall. And the wind just blowing it all back up here.
Since Jackson moved into this house nearly 1 year ago, her son has been hospitalized five times for asthma attacks so severe he could have died as he struggled to breathe. The experience has been so traumatic, she says her son now lives in fear that he won't survive another severe attack.
What can you say to a 13-year-old who gets that stuck in his head that every time he has an asthma attack, he thinks he's going to die?
Jackson has done everything she can to make her house free of the allergens and other things that could trigger her son's asthma. But there's nothing the 41-year-old single mom can do about the dust from the traffic and pollution on I-94. A map created by the Minnesota Department of Health shows that asthma hospitalization rates are highest along a corridor that starts in downtown Minneapolis and tracks north and west, roughly along the I-94 freeway through the metro area. There are many theories, but no one really knows what causes asthma. The disease affects all cultures, all incomes, all races, and all education levels. However, African Americans and American Indians have the highest asthma rates in the state and face some of the biggest challenges in managing the disease.
There's a tremendous disparity there.
Wendy Bruner is an epidemiologist with the Minnesota Department of Health Asthma Program, which tracks a number of asthma measures, among them emergency department visits, exposure to tobacco smoke, and asthma deaths. She says where people live can explain much of the racial disparity in asthma rates. Like Jackson and her son, many low-income people turn to rentals, where they may have less control over their living conditions.
We know in Minnesota that African Americans have the lowest home ownership rate in the state, and that has implications for somebody with asthma.
Rental housing can have old, dirty carpets, a big asthma trigger. Tobacco smoke from nearby apartments may seep into the units where people with asthma live. In many cases, there's nothing a renter can do about these problems. Landlords may prevent them from ripping out the carpet, and it may be too expensive to move somewhere else, or too difficult to find better housing that's close to public transportation.
Asthma is complicated, but really interesting in how it's connected to some of these bigger factors like housing and transportation and air quality and occupation and whether you own your own home or not.
The Minnesota Department of Health has tried to address some of the environmental asthma triggers. It has paid nurses and home health workers to look for possible mold, dust, and pest issues in the homes of people with especially severe asthma. That program has fixed problems in 64 homes. The agency is also trying to recruit landlords to voluntarily make their rental properties smoke-free. And a separate program run by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency retrofitted school buses across the state so the vehicles no longer spew diesel exhaust on their young passengers. But while these programs likely have had some positive effects on asthma cases, they won't be enough to eliminate the racial disparities in asthma rates. To a large degree, living well with asthma is also about having consistent access to primary care, uninterrupted insurance coverage, and a reasonable understanding of asthma medications, which can be expensive and confusing. Dr. Gail Brotman, a pediatric pulmonary specialist at Hennepin County Medical Center, has found that good asthma education is often a more important tool for her patients than trying to eliminate all of their environmental asthma triggers.
Even if you put them in better housing, if they don't have the right asthma controller medication, if their parents don't understand what medication to give them when, that it's just not going to work.
For example, Brotman says she frequently treats children who aren't doing as well as they should be because their parents have been giving them the wrong asthma medication. Medicine used to keep asthma under control works differently than the rescue medication used to stop an attack. Brotman says many parents are confused about the difference, and it doesn't help matters that the inhaler devices that deliver the drugs look similar. So when she can, Brotman refers her young patients who have poor asthma control to asthma camp, like this one. Brotman says asthma camp is a fun getaway where kids can learn how to use their medications in challenging conditions while they're surrounded by pollen and participating in sports.
All right, archers, go ahead and draw back. Fire at will. Nice shot.
This is Davion Davis's second year at Camp Super Kids, a five-day residential asthma camp near Loretto that's sponsored by the American Lung Association of Minnesota. So far, the slightly shy Minneapolis 9-year-old says he has enjoyed almost everything about his experience.
But the mosquitoes, they was bad. They was flying around a lot.
Davion, who is African American, has had asthma since he was a baby. Severe attacks have put him in the hospital nearly a dozen times. Now old enough to take on a bit more responsibility for his asthma care routine, he already has embraced one of the camp's key themes, making sure he keeps his asthma under control.
Because it's good to take your medicine, and you want to be an expert at taking your medicine.
The Lung Association says a week at Camp Super Kids helps children with asthma reduce their emergency department and hospital use in subsequent years. Its own data show that kids also miss fewer school days due to asthma than before. But even with all that Davion is learning at camp, his knowledge will be undermined by the harmful smoke exposure he faces when he returns home. His mother, Crystal Harris, admits that she smokes in her apartment.
I usually try to keep it to my room, but lately when it's been nicer outside, I go outside.
Harris, who's 30, knows she shouldn't smoke and plans to quit. She also has severe asthma, so severe that she's stopped breathing twice in her life. During one episode, she spent an entire month hooked up to a ventilator. But her choice to smoke is not as unusual as it might seem. Adults with asthma are just as likely as adults without asthma to smoke cigarettes. That's according to Minnesota data from a study conducted by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Harris, a single African-American mom who works the night shift as a security guard, says she started smoking to ease her stress.
Sometimes that becomes more of a problem than the breathing problem itself. That's what did it for me.
It is possible to live a healthy, active life with asthma, but as long as people smoke, as long as there's substandard housing, vehicle pollution, and uneven insurance coverage, asthma will always threaten the lives of some Minnesotans more than others. Lorna Benson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Minnesota is trying a new bridge construction method today on Interstate 35E. The road is being rebuilt for a Minpass lane and other improvements north of downtown St. Paul. That project includes rebuilding a number of bridges, including the Larpenteur Avenue Bridge over the interstate. That span was demolished in May. Crews have built a $3.5 million replacement just a few feet away, and they'll be pushing it into place tonight. Nancy Daubenberger is the state bridge engineer.
The crews will be using hydraulic jacks to slide the new bridge into the support systems. And mitigate risk to the traveling public, we're going to be closing down 35E since this is our first time trying this technology.
The freeway will close at 9 tonight in both directions between Interstate 94 and Highway 36. That stretch of 35E is expected to reopen tomorrow morning by 5 a.m. And finally, residents of the Dakotas may notice hazy skies this week as smoke from wildfires in Canada's Northwest Territories has made its way into the U.S. The National Weather Service says strong northwestern winds have brought the smoke to North and South Dakota from nearly 1,000 miles away. Well, at least it will make for pretty sunsets. That's the NPR News Update for Thursday, July 9th. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.